Welcome to episode 11 of the Discovery Files. We're going to do a recap of what we've found so far in the first 10 episodes of the show. So, Maude, we started off with Invincible, and I think my
before we get into it, let me ask you this question: did you think we would make it to 10 episodes?
I wasn't sure. I thought I might get like 5 and then like totally run out of steam because I wasn't sure if people would volunteer to be on the show or not, you know? And I think it was really nice that Aisha was the first one that actually, you know, said yes to being on the show, because I think a lot of other people realized that it wasn't that bad. So that was a big risk on her part, right?
That's right. Yeah, she could have been involved in the podcast that lasted one episode.
Yeah, it's great show.
Everyone else said get daft, and then they never showed up on our show. But
and I think that's actually like been one of my favorite things, is just people putting themselves out there for this, right? Because it's like, you know, there's always the worry about, you know, like being embarrassed or being wrong, you know, like I have the luxury of editing these and removing all of the stupid statements that I make. They don't have that luxury.
That's right. Yeah. You always make yourself look better than the guest, like, yeah, in that sense. Right?
But I think, like, what's been, how's it gone for you? What's your kind of viewpoint on 10 episodes into this?
Well, I mean, I think we spoke about this, I think, at length about why we wanted to do this podcast. And I guess what we tried to do with Invincible, what we tried to do with this podcast is kind of what we nailed with Invincible, in that, we wanted to show a Discovery from like multiple different angles. So Invincible, I had this list down, right? So we got 5 people from Invincible that came on. So Aisha, Dale, Julian, Steve, and Mark, like those, and also Aaron. Yeah. Aaron was the other guy. So 6 people that came on. What I liked about it was that all of these people were at like completely different levels in the team. I should say we had 7 because you were involved in it as well, right? So all of you guys were at like completely different levels, your perspectives on how you got into the team. Like, you know, some people came early, some people came kind of late. So in short, from my perspective, I think we did what we tried to set out to do, which is to show like one event from all these like different kind of angles. And I made this comment, I don't know if it like went into one of our episodes or not, but you know, there's this like really famous television series in Australia called The Slap. I kind of mentioned this before, right? And basically it's like, yeah, it was a really like popular book, and the premise of like the whole show is that I think it's 6 episodes. And the book is 6 chapters. And what it kind of shows is, like, the first chapter, there's a birthday party where one person slaps someone else's kid, right? So, like, quite a traumatic kind of event. And then the book kind of explains that event from, like, 6 different characters, you know, like the parents of the kid, the person that slapped it, people that were just at the party, et cetera. And, I've always felt that if I was a writer and I would create a miniseries, like what a cool way to create a miniseries, right? Like, yeah, like take one event and show it from like different characters' perspective. Now, that's not the only one that's done this. Yeah, there's movies that have done this as well and things like that. But that's kind of what I think about of Discovery when I think about it, right? Like, yeah, like my perspective on events could be completely different from someone else's perspective on events. And yeah, so I think what I would have liked to get out of the first 10 episodes was whether we could do it on one Discovery. And I think we did it with Invincible, right? Because we got so many different people.
I think that's actually a really fun part of it is I didn't maybe think there would be that many different points of view on the same thing, right? And it's actually good, you know, like talking about, you know, like the slap, right? Because it's, you know, it's a very memorable event. And yet everybody remembered it a little bit differently, you know? And it's like, there's, I don't know. So I really enjoyed, and also, you know, like hindsight, you know, it's been, you know, 13, 14 years or whatever. And so, you know, hindsight colors, you know, our memories. I remember a lot of the conversations with people kind of like before and after the recording is just like, you know, like they talked about like, oh, I didn't actually think I would like, you know, reminisce about this. And then, you know, hearing other people talk about it, it like jogged memories. And then I was like, oh, you know, I really want to talk about that if I ever go on the show. And so
that's high.
And I just wonder how many other experiences, like, you know, like the human experience is always that way, right? Where, you know, whatever you're going through with work or anything else, you know, they always say assume positive intent, because, you know, I think we default to negativity and to assuming something, you know, like that was worse than it really was. And oftentimes it's people were trying to do what they thought was best in the moment. And, you know, and it's all about how it's perceived. Right. So
also I think it kind of shows the like, you know, the frailty of decision making to some degree, right? Because you're kind of making decisions on unequal information, right? Like, yeah, like not everyone has all the information that they're kind of making a decision on. Yeah, like one of the classic points of that was like the interview with Julian, where yeah, like hopefully I could say this in a nicer way, but like, you know, you and I talked about the fact that you exited the team, and yeah, like, and it's because you had a perspective on what management, like Julie and the management, were doing at the time. And so it's not until, you know, like you kind of had the conversation with him and got like, you know, like where he remembered like aspects of I guess pressure or decisions he had to make under some level of unequal information that he had or incomplete information that he had. And so, and you don't get that perspective. I mean, you definitely didn't have that perspective at that time.
No, exactly.
From my understanding of it.
And I just remember like being, you know, like when we had that big layoff, I remember being like so frustrated, and it's like, you know, that stuff's like totally out of his hands. Right. And, you know, at the time I just, you know, wasn't like experienced enough to really reflect on that very much. And so that often, you know, like, you know, I've been involved in a few layoffs over the years, and it always feels like a very personal decision. Right. And so much of the time it's very much a business decision. And, you know, you realize later how much upper management actually went to bat for you. But the challenge being an upper management is you're representing the interest of the company downwards, and then you're representing the interest of your team upwards. And so you're almost this, you know, evil figure in everybody's eyes, right? Like where, you know, like your bosses, you know, are like, why are you always standing up for this, this, and this? And then your employees are like, why are you always such a piece of shit? You know, like,
yeah, yeah. How come you're not standing up for us?
Yeah, like, yeah.
And also, I think like, yeah, like things like in Julian's position, like I think, you know, like he can't, I don't know. And this is stuff I think about, right? Like you sometimes go like, as a manager in Julian's position, you can't go and explain the failure of your actions, because the consequence of that failure is people are losing jobs. Like, you know, the team is getting cut apart. So, and so, yeah, so at some point, yeah, I think it's like a hard position to be in. Like, you know, like having been a manager in this position before as well, I think it's hard because you kind of go and you go like, you know, like, am I, like, is it better for me to portray myself as the architect and take some of the, like, you know, like, and cop some of the hiding or like the frustration that people have? And like, you know, should I swallow that to make my team feel good? Or should I portray myself as a victim here who's being like, you know, suppressed by upper management as well? And what's the right like methodology? Like, you know, if I play the victim, are people just going to think I'm an asshole and then not never deal with me again? Or is it better for me to like portray that I'm like the stoic management and they can vent on me and then move past it and they can have some catharsis around it?
Yeah. You're in that land of no friends. Right. And then there's all the things that you can't say. And, you know, like I remember I had one layoff and we had a really good HR manager. And she took me aside and kind of like coached me on, you know, what I could and couldn't say to the teams. And one of the things like she, you know, like she stressed is she's like, you cannot apologize to the people. You can't say, I'm really sorry, this is going on. She's like, one, it doesn't help them. And two, you know, you can create big issues for the company down the road in terms of like lawsuits and other things like that. And so she was basically like, this is what you can talk about. This is what you can't. And I remember like just sitting in these meetings, you know, with my, because I ended up getting, I laid off three of my four employees. And so that was a wonderful moment, just sitting there and being like, you know, people are going, well, why'd you pick me? You know, and a lot of it was stuff like, in the background, you know, we'd done all this weighing of like, okay, well, if I end up getting laid off down the road, we need someone who's a, you know, professional geologist who can, you know, like then be the only person here. Because if we keep this other person and then, you know, I get laid off, they can't work here under the, you know, the regulations. You know, they have to have, you know, like you have to have a professional geologist, you know, cert to do that.
Yeah.
And it's like, and I'm like, you know, but that doesn't bring anybody any comfort when you're telling them that, you know, like, and I just think about those things a lot where I've seen people make a lot of mistakes and try to be like chummy with the, you know, the people and be like, yeah, this is a bullshit decision from upper management and blah, blah, blah. And it's, you know, it might feel that way and you might want to say that, but you all honestly can't very much. And so, you know, in hindsight, I look back and I'm like, man, Julian played that well. He did really, really well. Because he must have just been going through hell doing that, you know, because like, you know, I know he had like especially talking to him before and after the episodes, he respected the team a bunch. Right. And so that's like, that can't have been easy to be just that, you know, you're the bad guy. And he never, you know, he never like tried to put the blame on somebody else. You know, he never tried to, you know, like make it sound like, oh, look, I really didn't want to do this. It was very much.
Yeah.
Business decision. We have to do this. This is the cold hard facts of it. And you know, like, and the interesting thing with the people we interviewed is if my memory serves, none of those people got caught up in that layoff. But that doesn't mean that other people who were involved in, like, you know, St. Ives and in Invincible who got laid off were not worth talking to in this podcast. It just goes to like,
that's
how
fine.
Many people can we talk to? Like, you know, like there's a limit, you know, like I think we have.
Yeah.
On the team. You know, it was a big team.
But I think, I mean, this is, I guess this is the one thing that I kind of like find about Discoveries is that going back to kind of the premise of this podcast, you know, like one of the things that I found frustrating when I started, like, you know, like really delving into what is the actual mechanics of a Discovery look like, you know, like what happens to a group, what happens to, you know, like people in that sense. And yeah, like, and I haven't been through the process like you guys did where you got Invincible to a large point, like, you know, like it was a major Discovery and it had a big impact on the business and things like that. You know, like the Discoveries I've been involved in are where they, like, you know, they didn't have the impact on the business the way it should have, but we still like monetized it somehow, right? So we kind of got through the process. But what I find is that, yeah, like my recollection of being through that process is that, like I find it was like I was completely wrecked, full of anxiety and uncertainty or being uncertain about what we were going to do. Like, you know, like, is it good? Is it bad? Like, you know, are these results that are coming in, are they really good? Are they really bad? Yeah, like, so like, for example, like, you know, I was part of a private equity fund and like, you know, like we bought a project which we thought had targets, and then we started drilling these targets and like, you know, the targets started returning pretty good stuff. And then you always have this like kind of imposter syndrome thinking like, you know, like have we just found something that the company like, you know, kind of already knew about and left for some reason. So, you know, so like, you're like, well, like, why would they leave if they knew this? Like, I'm basically reading their report and going, they thought this was a good target. I'm just drilling it and I'm finding something. Like, you know, like, why did they leave? Like, does it mean that they know more than I do? Like, you know, like, is this a shit thing? Like, should I be drilling?
Yeah, it's like, have I made a giant mistake? And I've been involved in something just like that where, you know, like we drilled out because of all of the little infrastructure things that had to happen. It couldn't be drilled before, right? And so then eventually we were able to access this area that nobody had been able to access. And we drilled a target that everybody who had ever worked on that project came up with. And it was like pretty much exactly what we thought it would be. It wasn't like, you know, like a total game changer, but it was good. And
yeah.
But it was that same thing. It was like, well, if it was really this good, wouldn't they have just like gone through the effort to get over here anyways? Like maybe they just knew it wasn't this good. And then you're like, you know, well, like how much can we really glean from the mapping and from the other things? And like, and you get to a point where it's like, you actually can't really tell that until the truth machine's turning, you know, like you think you can. You think like, you know, like, oh, we're clever enough to be able to you know, weigh and dismiss, you know, that.
And I think like, yeah, I think this is where like, you know, like the concept of this podcast to me was really kind of born, was that I just think that Yeah, like we talk about this, like, yeah, like discovery is not an event. It's a series of events, and it has a series of players in it, and people that kind of play around. Yeah, like another classic example of this is like, yeah, like I was part of a nickel exploration group in BHP, and yeah, we had this idea that which was built on like other people that have worked. Of finding a deposit in a fold nose, right? And like a fold enclosure. But it probably took us, I think like 5 or 7 years to kind of figure out how we could structurally map and collect all the structural data that we needed to kind of predict the periodicity of these fold noses that we would get. All right. And so I was involved in the part where we came up with the idea and went, oh yeah, we should map fold noses. And then it took us like another 5 or 6 years to figure out how the hell are we going to map these. Yeah. By the time I'd moved on. But I distinctly remember having that conversation with the geologist sitting there going, I'm like, well, yeah, like if we need to find another one of these, we need to be able to map these fold noses, right? And then the person going, yeah. I'm like, how are we going to do that? They're like, well, we don't have data. Yeah. Right? And then the whole process kind of kicks off along the way. Now, I'm not saying I'm intimately involved in that discovery of eventually that led to that discovery. But yeah, if I don't have that conversation with the guy, or the way we had that conversation, maybe the process doesn't kick off in the way it kicked off afterward. And so I think that's what my experience of being in discoveries has been like. It's this anxious kind of it's exciting. It was great. It was really rewarding and all of that stuff. But yeah, but there's also a serious level of the situation dripping with anxiety about uncertainty, about you not really being clear about what you're going to kind of do. And then on the other hand, when I hear these discovery stories from people and they put up this slide pack saying that, oh man, we knocked it out of the park. We did A, but then we did B, and then we did C, and then we did D. And you go, that's obviously bullshit, because that's not how the story works.
Yeah. And it's kind of I thought, I really enjoyed Dale's episode on how much it tied off all of these questions I had at St. Ives, right? And so, with Mac Briggs. But essentially he had this vision of where he wanted the team to go technically and how to improve. It was this long-term strategic vision. And then he just started pushing towards it to make it happen. And so then you look at, it resulted in a number of discoveries, Invincible Genes, being one of them. And I was thinking about how there's so much luck involved with who was involved and who did this and who did that. But there's also mm-hmm. so much strategy where, it took someone pushing on a more or less daily basis to affect those changes. So that by the time I started there, I just thought it was the norm. And I thought that, that came from WMC. And then to find out oh no, that's really a Goldfields, push from Matt, that's pretty incredible. And then I thought about it a little bit, and I don't think I talked about it in any of the episodes, but one of the reasons, Dale and I had been kind of moving, people around in our teams after we kind of discussed our strengths and weaknesses. And I'd done some work in mining and drilling out resources before that. And so I ended up taking on the Invincible kind of drill out. And I remember I needed someone to manage it. And it was before we knew it was a discovery, obviously. It was just going to be a terrible air corps program, and it was going to be, crap.
That's right.
Tell me if I've already told the story, but so I asked for volunteers, and I didn't get any volunteers. So I was like, okay, well, we really need this thing to move forward. So if I don't have a volunteer by tomorrow, then I'm going to choose someone to run this Air Corps program. And then Aisha came in later that day, and she's covered head to toe in mud, she'd fallen into the thing. And then said, I heard you need a volunteer. And so I was like, yep, no, that's great. And so I put her in that. And then later I chose her to manage that program because she was a go-getter, and she volunteered when everybody was looking at how hot it was out on the Salt Lake. And I just kind of think about, of that wasn't a deeply strategic choice I'd made. It wasn't I went, let me weigh the strengths and weaknesses of my team. It's I needed someone who was passionate and driven, and And that ended up being Aisha, who ended up being the exact person that needed to be there to do that drill out.
I know. And this is the point that I find interesting, right? Like, in hindsight, Aisha was the right person to run the ECHO program, right? But the way you're telling me the story is, at the time, it was just, I don't know, let's call it pure ass luck that it was Aisha that put her hand up, right?
100%.
Now, right? Now, Aisha could have put a hand up for something else the day before, and then that meant you would have lost the resource that Aisha was during the whole process.
Yeah, well, like, and you think about that, like, you know, someone else might have volunteered, and maybe they would have done really well, but yeah, it's all those little decisions that make, like, just massive differences in how things go.
Yeah. You know,
like,
in hindsight does the value of that decision make sense, right?
Like, and,
it's not in foresight at all.
Absolutely. And it would be easy to turn around and say stuff like, you know, like, oh, well, you know, we knew this. And so, you know, we evaluated the strengths of our team and we decided to have this person manage it because they had the, you know, like, and like, no, it was more or less like blind ass luck, right? Where it was like, oh, you know, like, who's willing to do some terrible work on the Salt Lake?
Yeah, that's right. So, and I think that's when we did like Exploration Radio, like, you know, we obviously researched a lot of other scientific discoveries. Or I should say I researched a lot of other scientific discoveries because I wanted to know, like, is this a common trait, right? Like, is it a common trait in most discoveries? And yeah, like we did this episode with this lady, Samantha Copeland, yeah, who's a researcher who basically studied serendipity and scientific discovery. And her like research kind of showed the same thing is that, in foresight, like, it's very hard to figure out what's the value of a decision you make. Right. But in hindsight, you know the value of that decision completely. And she gave this great example. Like, you know, we were talking about, like, the discovery of Erzberg and Gratzberg, right? So for people that don't know that story, you know, like, basically it started off with a Dutch geologist named Jacques Dozee, who was actually trying to climb the glaciers, in Karstens Pyramid, like, you know, the massive kind of mountain. And the reason why that is it's the only tropical glacier in the world. It's like a big thing for people to want to climb. And so, yeah, so this guy obviously goes on this expedition to climb this glacier. And then he hires a local tribe to take him up to the base of the mountains. Now, that tribe lived in a valley where at the end of the valley was a wall of oxidized copper material, right? Which the tribe used for certain things, like, you know, to make certain artifacts and things like that. Now, if he had picked some other tribe, they would have taken him up some other valley, and he would not have seen that. And then he would not have made a note that was then found by the Freeport guys, the Forbes, Wilson, and yada yada yada. So the value of him picking that tribe could not have been known at that moment. It could have only been known 50 years later when Erzberg was discovered. And so I think there are so many of these moments, like when you go through it. And that's kind of what I mean about, like, the level of anxiety and uncertainty and just kind of, like, blindness. I actually call it, I term it blindness. Like, you know, you're kind of blind to what decisions you're making and what impact they're really going to have. And you're only going to know about that in, like, 10 years' time.
Yeah. And it's kind of like that same thing that happened with Andover, right? Where it's like, I think it was one of the fieldies that had worked in, like, mineralized pegmatites before and was like, hey, you know, guys, there might be some lithium in this. And it's like, with what they were looking for, you know, that lithium borate fusion, you're not going to assay for lithium, right? And so it's just
correct.
Like, So it's only because someone recognized that and like, you know, you go back in hindsight and you're like, well, you know, we hired a really well-rounded team. We wanted some people that, you know, like, no way, right? Like, it's like
yeah, yeah. Yeah, no one like sat down and went, you know what, we should hire fieldies that know about mineralized pegmatites in case we find one.
Yeah.
You know, like that was not like the criteria about, like, oh, John, do you have lithium pegmatite experience? Like, you know, like we've checked that. Yeah, that's obviously bullshit. And I think Paul did a good job of kind of explaining that, right? Like, but this is where I think like the serendipitous part of it kind of comes in that, yeah, you know, like serendipity is about the recognition and the opportunity, right? Mm. So, you know, so they had the opportunity, but they needed the team to recognize that it was an opportunity and then move ahead with it. You know, like, and that's the role I think Paul and Josh and yeah, Ellie, who you know, like the other guys.
Yeah, it's not
on the team,
just but, luck, right? It's just like, you know, like it's like that, you know, chance favors the prepared mind quote. And I think about that where, you know, like my conversation with Nick, I really enjoyed one part of it. He was talking about he's had more of those type moments in the field than anywhere else.
Yeah.
And that's been my experience as well. And I think you don't have the chance for luck if you're sitting behind a computer screen all the time, right? Like you're not making, you know, like I think Dale was saying, you know, that like you can create situations that you can take advantage of, right? And it's like, but if you're just behind the computer screen, you're not really setting yourself up to have that serendipitous luck on,
I know.
You know, hey, did you guys see this lithium bearing pegmatite?
I know. Yeah, like if there's, I mean, this will be interesting. Maybe we can have this after like whatever 50 episodes or 100 episodes if we get there. Is that, you know, like, is that, like, you know, is that the lesson that you kind of come out of it? Is that at some point, like, you know, to do something, you have to do something. Yeah, like you can't, like as much as you strategize and much as you do all of these type of things, like, at the end of the day, you have to do something. And that's, I think, the recognition of the moment, right? Like, you know, like Andover, yeah, Invincible is the same, that even though you guys found mineralization in the wrong area, like, you know, the opportunity was there, and there was a recognition of the opportunity to the various team members that led you to kind of finding it. And same with Dozy, right? Like, yeah, Dozy recognized that it's a wall of copper. Yeah. You know, like he's like, maybe I have to make a note of it, right?
And it goes back to like, curiosity while on vacation, right? You know, like where like he's out there to think of anything but geology probably, and then like all geologists going, oh, look at that rock, oh, look at that rock, and going, oh, well, maybe we should get a little closer to that. Do you have any samples of that I could take? Because I think they even had samples in the museum, right?
So, that's right. Yeah and I mean, it's interesting, like you read like Dozy's diary, you know, like I had a friend translate parts of it for me, and like, you know, you read his diary and like, you know, like it's like quite clear that he was uncertain about what he had found, because he's like, you know, like I have never seen this before. So on one hand, he recognizes that it's something unusual. On the other hand, he's kind of questioning himself about whether what he's seeing could actually be true or not, right? And so, and then what's funny is like, you know, like I watched this like documentary that was done by Freeport, you know, like with someone from Freeport was like kind enough to send to me. And in that, you know, he's like, I recognized that it was a wall of copper and it could be a really good copper deposit. And you're like, again, that's obviously bullshit, because what you wrote about in your thing was that you weren't certain, like, what the hell is this thing? Like, yeah. Like, and
you
so
know, you get stuff like that, and it's so weird that it's often hard to recognize. Like, actually, I was really struck by like Nick Tate in his interview. I always enjoy Nick's videos because like I kind of am terrible at mineralogy. And so like, I really have to struggle through it. And he's doing these videos where he's like, well, this is this mineral and this is this mineral. And then he was like, well, I saw this rock that I was like, I have no idea what this is. And I was like, oh my gosh, if it happened to Nick, I would have gotten there and been like, totally clueless. You
know? Yeah.
My
that's hard.
Would have been like, I need to stop being a geologist.
I know. And this is where I think like sometimes I don't know what it is. Like, you know, psychology, there's this concept called like the fragility of knowledge, in that, you know, like experts are actually quite fragile with their knowledge, because like, yeah, like a small change can like completely unravel their whole kind of knowledge base, right? And, like, you know, if you read like Nassim Taleb, and, you know, he has this like great example of a turkey, right? Like, you know, you feed a turkey on the first day, and then you ask it, like, what are the chances you're going to get fed tomorrow? And the turkey's like, well, I don't know, man, like pretty low, because I've only been fed today. right? And then you ask it after 100 days and you go, what are the chances you're going to get fed on the 101st day? The turkey's like, well, yeah, like a little bit higher because I've been fed for 100 days straight, right? And then you like ask it after 200 days and 300 days and all the way up to like the 1,000th day. And yeah, and then you ask the turkey like, hey, what are the chances you're going to get fed on the 1,001st day? And the turkey's like, man, guarantee you because I've been fed for 1,000 days. Like, yeah, like there's no chance I'm not going to get fed tomorrow, right? But tomorrow's Thanksgiving and the turkey's going to be dead, right? And So the turkey's like knowledge base is so fragile because it has acquired all this knowledge.
Yeah.
And I think that's like, you know, like to some degree, I think when we kind of tell these stories, like, you know, we don't actually account for like how fragile our knowledge base was at the time that we were kind of looking at opportunities or dealing with that opportunity in that sense.
And I was kind of like reflecting a little bit on one of the other commonalities with like the Invincible discovery that really like blew me away in hindsight. Is how well supported that team was to do just geology. You know, like you had Steve, you know, Radford doing like, you know, running all the field crews and the core farm and all these other things. And you think about like, I've had plenty of jobs where I've been focused on how am I going to get drill mud here tomorrow? And the last thing I'm thinking about is geology and figuring out something. And so I can't help but think of, again, a very intentional change, you know, that would have had pretty serious budget implications. Someone would have to sell that, you know, like to budget to have all these fieldies and to have, you know, like Steve, you know, doing that. And you go like, well, what if you didn't have that, you know, like, and Nick, you know, was instead of thinking up target ideas, if he was labeling sample bags, maybe he wouldn't have thought about this, right? Like maybe.
That's right.
And so it goes back to like, you know, I read a LinkedIn post today where someone was talking about how they're going to make like essentially a recipe book for how to do exploration and make your success better. And I, as much as I would love to see something like that happen, like, you know, gold is valuable because it's not a recipe that works, right? But there's certainly so much commonality in all of our interviews we've done, so much commonality. Like I know nothing about, you know, lithium pegmatites and hardly anything about nickel, you know, and I loved listening to the discussion, you know, like where I was occasionally trying to contribute there, but like I was just struck in the moment with, wow, I know nothing about this commodity. And yet everything about this interview could have been about any other ore deposit I've worked on. And
yeah, that's why.
And so I go, maybe we don't have a recipe book that we create, but maybe what we can do is we can say, these are the things that help and these are the things that hurt discovery chances. And,
one of the comments that I found really interesting was like, yeah, like, so we've done Invincible and we've done like Andover Lithium. And so what's interesting is that, you know, to me is that there are definite commonalities in how the team responded to challenges and opportunities that were in front of them, right? But the makeup of the two teams could not have been more different, right?
Yeah,
like you guys had all the logistics help. You know, you had Steve, you had Enviros, you have all of this kind of stuff, like, you know, like set up. You know, you in some ways the St. Ives team had been primed, and that's what Dale kind of talked about. Like, you know, you had all these small discoveries, you had these production kind of challenges that they'd worked out, and they, you know, like they'd stepped up all the way to like, yeah, you had incredible, like, you know, like the kind of failed discovery, and then you had Invincible, and then yada, all of that stuff was all primed for you to be like right there. You know, the team had kind of honed their craft. You know, it's like a sports team, right? You like, you played in the playoffs or the finals, so, you know, like you knew the pressure, and like, and then like now you were in the grand final of like the premiership kind of championship game. And so, you know, so all of that happened. You look at Andover, it was a complete opposite. You know, it was a ragtag group of, you know, like five people, you know, like put like, yeah, it was a team pulled together. Like, I hope I'm not like insulting Paul.
But it's like
duct taped together. Yeah, they had a nickel thing, and then the nickel market kind of wobbled, and then they were like, what do we do? Oh, like, hey, the field is talking about some lithium pegmatites. Yeah, let's go check it out. You know, like, and then Paul goes to like the museum and goes, actually, the samples, like, you know, like they are museum grade samples of lithium bearing pegmatites in the same area that we have. Maybe we should go look for lithium bearing pegmatites. Yeah. And so, but so like the physical kind of construct of the team in Andover versus Invincible could not have been completely different. You know, Junior versus a home season kind of mid-tier mining company, right?
I think that's what, one of the things that's so fascinating is, you know, I lucked out to work on a lot of teams that had different discoveries. Every one of them was a wildly different composition, right? And so sometimes I'm tempted to be like, well, team building is how we can get to discoveries. And then I go, but that refutes my own experience, you know, like where I work for places. And there was like, you know, me and a couple of like interns that I hired and it's just like, and, you know, like a mining engineer, right? And then, you know, you work at other places where it's this, you know, like well-oiled machine of geologists and it's everything in between. And I go, so maybe it's hiring people that like another commonality is how different, like true diversity of experience is like important. And so maybe it's like, okay, be really intentional about having different experience, you know, in your team so that people recognize things that you don't. So maybe that's a commonality. And then I go, and having people who are passionate and who are willing to, like, you know, grind through the terrible moments of life when it happens, because that's the other commonality of all these discoveries is they weren't easy. They were through terrible moments and difficult times and, you know, heat and snow and everything else. And so, you know, maybe grit is much more determining factor than we give it credit for.
That's right. Yeah. And I think that's kind of the part that I find interesting is that the way people took the opportunities or recognized the opportunities in the two teams was very similar. Yeah, like Aisha recognized that this was gold. Yeah, like, yeah, she didn't care what stratigraphic unit it was in. And she's like, yeah, we're finding gold. Well, we're here, our job is to find gold and I'm finding gold. So until someone can take the gold out of the intersections we're having, I'm going to advocate to keep drilling it. And Julian probably did the same, or you did probably the same, right? And the same with the guys at Andover, like, you know, they started hitting lithium pegmatites. Yeah, so Josh and Paul and the team put their heads together to see, well, how can we keep finding more? Well, we keep finding more. So hence, like, you know, like, screw whatever model we had or whatever we thought our starting point was, you know, like, we're now going to chase this. And so they recognized the opportunity and they took advantage of it.
And that was the same thing in Nick's story as well. It's just like, you know, that first deposit he talked about, it was, you know, very different than what reports had described it as. And then like figuring it out, I was like, oh, well, this could have some pretty big implications. And
yeah, that's right. That's right. And I think this, like, to your point about, you know, like people that kind of like talk about, like, you know, like what's like the top 10, like, you know, LinkedIn list of how to find, like, you know, like mineral deposits, like what discovery steps look like. You know, like I've never been a fan of that because I think it's like, you know, it's not something that can be kind of like corporatized to, like, you know, like we can't do it this way. Like, you know, like, sure, you have a game plan and you have all the strategy and all of that stuff, but I don't think you can, like, kind of create it like, you know, like do these 10 things and you're going to, you know, like to do great, right? Like, it's like, you know, like I kind of say, like, yeah, like a fitness plan, right? Like, fitness trainer, like, yeah, like get a PT and, you know, like, and they can give you a plan. But, you know, that's not the incredible part. The incredible part is trying to get yourself to the gym on a regular basis so you can actually, like, yeah, like do the plan. That is the part that is the failure point.
And then, yeah, exactly. That's where everybody falls over. And it's, I was just thinking about how there's so many kind of, concepts out in geology right now. And I see them on LinkedIn all the time because I obviously use LinkedIn a lot. And but you see all these concepts out there and they're thrown out there like, oh, if you just did this, I'm like, you know, and I hate to maybe be too critical of things, but, like, you know, you see the mineral systems discussion, right? And it's kind of funny because I remember, like, you know, watching a presentation years back on, like, you know, the mineral system, you know, like method for discovery. And we need to do this to have the, you know, like the, our criteria of what will allow us to have a big deposit. And then I'm like, well, if you actually look on the paper that Cam McQuaig wrote, he wrote, don't do that thing that you just did, you know, like,
that's right.
It's like, you know, like have like it's, you don't want to have it be ingredients for success. You want to be like, these are the ingredients for walking away. But that's a much harder thing to define, right? Is like, when do you
yeah, walk, yeah.
Right? And it's, So I think like, you know, what I keep going back to is it's like an individual at various stages, various individuals, not just one, recognizing critical moments without being able to define that it's a critical moment and acting in the exact right way. And so then it makes me go like, well, how many discoveries are out there where that critical moment was reached and someone didn't act in the right way, you know, and yep. sat there on a shelf, you know, like, you know, we were talking about earlier where you have this, you know, like deposit, you start drilling out and it's just like, and you're like, maybe I'm wrong. Like, it seems too easy.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all right. I mean, that like in a lot of ways, that's been my experience more about, like when you've had success. Yeah. Like, I don't think it's been like, and maybe that's because I haven't discovered a thing like Norilsk. Like, you know, like if I drill into 60 meters of massive sulfide, yeah, pretty good chance I know I found something major here. Like that there will be no anxiety or uncertainty about that. But most of the time, like, yeah, like the early stages of it, you go, I don't know, like, yeah, like is this good? Like, yeah, because I'm reading a report from like 5 years ago where some junior geologists identified this as a worthwhile target. And then there were 5 years of no activity on this target. Yeah. So like, what am I missing? Like, yeah, like why did they not drill? Am I the putz that's going to go and like drill this thing? And yeah, like people are going to go, why did you drill it? Because it's obviously like wrong in that
obviously
sense.
Obviously they passed up on it 5 years ago for a reason.
Yeah. Like, and so, yeah, so I think that's like, I don't know that, you know, like if nothing else, if you can kind of show like, you know, like other people going through the process that's a normal thing, like that's more the feeling people have rather than this, like, you know, like standing on top of the mountain pointing and like going, you know, we obviously need to go there. Like, yeah. That's not the image of discovery. I think it's a completely opposite.
Yeah. No, it's, and like, you know, how many deposits you hear that are discovered by, you know, like water holes, you know, like water wells. And it's like, yeah. And then in hindsight, it's like, oh, you know, this and this and this is going on. And it's like, and then you can,
yeah, we were doing sterilization drilling for an airport or a tailings dam. And we found a nobody. And people were like, of course it was supposed to be there. Yeah. Like we were just putting the tailings dam there to test you, to figure out whether you wanted it there or not. Yeah. It's like clearly, like, you know, there is a level of like intellectual squidginess in this, right? And this is what I kind of mean about the fragility of knowledge, in that, you know, like it's only in hindsight do we kind of explain all the steps along the way. You know, like it's not in kind of like foresight that you have all of this stuff sitting in front of you.
And I think that's the interesting part, right? Is like you can have a discussion with the same person on different days and get different answers, you know, like to the point where there's that comic where it was like, you know, how do you get a straight answer from a geologist? Well, you have to cut off one hand so they can't say, but on the other hand.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's like, I was thinking about like, I was mapping in this one district and I'd read about a guy who had done some phenomenal mapping in the 1930s. And so it was like, oh, this is really, really good mapping. What was his secret? So I read some of his kind of write-ups on his mapping program. And essentially, like, he had a mapping partner, which was usually like a university student. And it was kind of cool because I ended up meeting one of the guys that was one of his mapping partners, who then became like head of the U.S. Bureau of Mines at one point. So it was kind of an interesting tie into this. And he said, and that guy's experience totally aligned with what this guy wrote. His name is Vincent Gianelli. And he would be on one part of the ridge, you know, mapping, and the student would be like down lower mapping, and then they would switch sides and then they would come back. And yeah. And he's like, and you would see it, you know, because you walk over the exact ground the other person mapped and you would have disagreements and they would be calling out to each other as they were going. And they're like, oh, well, I'm in this unit. And he's like, no, that's not that unit. I was just up there. And then they would walk over to it. And it's like the lighting was different. There was a little bit of water on the rock or whatever. And he's like, and so this process made it so that they made much more reliable maps, because he said if it was just him going, you know, he might never go back over that, because you're always trying to traverse new terrain, right? And so it was one of the lessons I took, because I was, of course, by myself because I was a junior, and so like I didn't have any mapping partners. And later I did, but at the time I didn't. And so I from reading this went, okay, well then I should plan my traverses to come back on another traverse that I've done before. And so that way I'll see it from the other angle. And I started doing that, which made for a lot more hiking, but I ended up like, I felt I came up with a halfway decent map, you know? And so I just think about like the vagaries of us as scientists, where it's like, you know, like what direction you're mapping can make a difference on what rock units you call things. That's kind of a, and this is no inexperienced mapper that's doing this, right? Like this guy was amazing. And he pointed that out. And so I was like, oh, there's a lot of really subtle arts in our science that that are kind of neglected maybe in the discussion.
That's right. And I think one of the things that I found interesting, like after we did like exploration radio, because, you know, there's a part where we, like I went and like, I particularly went and talked to like many different academics working in other industries. Like they were kind of trying to understand the rate of discovery or understand the rate of success and like in various industries. And what I found was that, this is a common problem in other industries as well. I think we have this view that, because geology is a relatively young science, we don't exactly know a lot of the stuff that we're kind of doing. But I don't think it's actually that different in other industries. When I talked to Samantha, I mentioned that she research serendipity, right? And then her thesis was that what is the ethics of clinical trials when you have serendipitously found something that you weren't actually trialing, right? So what's the ethics of running the clinical trial? The classic case is Viagra, right? Viagra was a medicine developed for something else and it solves a completely different problem. What if you come across something like that where the clinical trial is actually not testing the thing that the medicine is actually going to solve now? And so, so this is a common problem in drugs, in pharma, where, they will develop something and then through the trials or after, the medicine will actually solve a completely different problem and go completely differently. And so, we're not unique in that sense. It happens in physics a lot as well. People come up with, in physics, you have theoretical physicists that come up with theories about how things should work. And then you have experimental physicists that actually run the experiment and figure it out. And sometimes it's huge diversity in what the results actually end up being, right? So we're not unique in that sense. This kind of vagary of outcome is not unique to us.
We were talking earlier about reading various books on discoveries and things like that, and that reminded me, I went on this big kick where I started reading all these Richard Feynman books because I found his discussions on discovery in physics was so similar to the issue we are having in geology that I went, oh, maybe there's some lessons to be learned here. And it's, maybe the lesson is to have someone as brilliant as Richard Feynman on your team,
But that's a great example. Feynman's thing was, I don't know, I'm not exactly sure what you read, but the stuff that I read, which was along the same lines, right, where he said that often they are these labels put on things in physics, we understand gravity as a force, we understand electromagnetics as a force, but then there's this thing in physics called the theory of everything, right, where they think that there's got to be a combining factor between all of these kind of forces as well. So maybe what physics does really well is they label this stuff. They label it and go, well, we know there has to be something unknown out there, and so we kind of do it. And the best example I have of this is maps. When people used to make maps, they would go, well, we don't know what's here, but we think there is a sea full of dragons. We'll put that in, right? And then someone will go into that sea looking for dragons, and then they won't find anything, or some serpent or something like that. And they go, actually, there's nothing there, right? And so I think we always have this kind of unknown that sits out there. It's just that in certain disciplines, they started labeling them, right? Yeah. And then so it started calling them out or saying that there is an entity we don't understand, and we will work towards getting to that part.
And I think that it goes back to one of the discussions I really enjoyed in the podcast was doing things like targeting sessions where you're actually trying to like essentially label what are the known knowns, what are the known unknowns.
Yeah.
And maybe you'll start to, you know, maybe you don't fill in the here be dragons part of the sea, but you can extend the shoreline a little bit. And it's like, and you can start maybe defining where you need to look to understand something better, you know, like where it's like, okay, we don't know this. How do we go about trying to solve it? How do we be intentional about trying to solve this? And
yeah, how do we collect data to fill in that missing part, right? Like, how do we, and that's like, and if you read, you know, like if this podcast runs long enough, you know, we should read books by like actual explorers that, you know, that went and found various things in the physical world. And yeah, and that's really what kind of drove them. You know, like they, I remember there's this like great book, if anyone ever has a chance to read, it's called The Dragon Hunters. You know, it was all these people that went into Central Asia looking for dinosaur fossils. And yeah, basically, like, you know, they had an idea that, you know, like this part of Central Asia, obviously, you know, like through its geological history had been a certain, like a good hunting ground for dinosaurs or for fossils. And so they're like, you know, they're like, well, there should be fossils here. So there was just all these people that were just driving all around Mongolia and like the central stands looking for dinosaur fossils. And a lot of them found stuff because, you know, it was just a big question mark on the map. And yeah, and that's what drove these guys to go find it. And I think stuff like that is like, you know, like your point in that, you know, maybe in the targeting sessions, it's the question marks we should kind of look at and try to figure out, you know, like how could they fit into this space? Mm. But that's a hard proposition. You know, that's, you know, like talk about anxiety kind of things. Like, you know, that's a very anxiety driven kind of process.
I mean, think about like what you're talking about earlier, where it's like, you know, if you're trying, like, I think you were talking about in another conversation we had where if you're looking in nickel and then you're like, oh, well, let's target fold noses. Well, how much work has to go into figuring out where these fold noses are? And I think you said it was like 5 or 7 years later that they finally started doing it. And that's been my experience too, where it's like, you know, I remember suggesting we remap one of the projects I was at because like we had Nick Oliver out and he had done a bunch of phenomenal work helping us to realize that we hadn't even seen some critical structures in our mapping. And so then it was like, okay, well, this has never been mapped. And so somebody's got to do it. And it was like, this could take us 3, maybe 5, maybe 6 months. And yeah. It's like, well, if we don't start now, then we'll never finish it. So
that's right.
And that was kind of the thing was, it's like, okay, sometimes you have to take on these longer projects where you don't even know for sure they're going to help you figure something out. And maybe it will be critical and maybe it won't. And but if you don't ever start, you know, you won't ever be able to answer that question.
If we can get to a point where we get to like 100 episodes, yeah, you know, like I think that's kind of the message that I'd be interested in kind of learning about along the way is that, you know, like what are the aspects? You know, if I only worked on Invincible, I would think that, you know, like a certain level of corporate infrastructure would be important. Now, maybe that is important in taking the discovery from like, you know, discovery to production in 3 years or whatever it was. Or it was shorter than that. I can't remember what but it was a short
4 months, something like that. But
yeah, so very short amount of time, right? So maybe the infrastructure is important to take a discovery through its kind of development cycle and production and all of that stuff. Maybe that's where infrastructure matters, right? But maybe it doesn't matter in how the team evaluates opportunities or recognizes opportunities, because maybe that's more down to the people in the team, not necessarily the infrastructure available.
And it's a good point, right? Where I was thinking about like with Nick's discussion on like the single person discovery, where it's like you don't have any of those resources, and that project is kind of languished, right? And so, you know, maybe if
or the challenge, like, yeah, you know, the thing I got out of like Nick's interview was the challenge is that if it's just you, you are limited by your knowledge and capability.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe that is the biggest limiting step of why, like, things just don't move along. It's because, yeah, it's just you, man. Like, you know, like, you're one bricklayer, right? Like, you can only put so many bricks, like, yeah, like, you know, like, if you're building the Great Wall of China, like, yeah, like, it might take you a whole lifetime before you build it. But what if you had, like, more people around? Like, you know, like, in that... Or what if you had technology? Like, you know, like how could you augment your skill set, you know, like in various ways? So that I think is a limitation of like That's what I got out of like Nick's thing was that, yeah, ultimately he might have just been limited by the ideas he had and the capability he had.
No, it's a good point, because like I know when I've worked by myself, there's always you tend to know your own limitations. And I remember just kind of lamenting not having people to bounce ideas off of, because a lot of times I think out loud. And so like I need someone to talk to think, you know, about some of these big issues and stuff. And if you don't have that, it's very hard to do. So I was going to ask you, what's like, you know, because you had a nice long run with Exploration Radio, and this is a little bit different format and different things. What's been your favorite experience about the podcast so far?
About this podcast, you mean, like the Discovery File? You know, like one of the things now that I reflect back on Exploration Radio, which I wish I had done in that, was, yeah, like the way we created content in Exploration Radio was that we did a lot of it off air. Yeah, like so again, like there was a lot of research I did. There was a lot of research our production team did, you know, like in the early days when Steve was around. Like, you know, we did a lot of research off air. And one of the things that I find now that we're doing with the Discovery Files is that I think we do that research on air. And I think that's a little bit more interesting, because I think people could see the evolution of ideas along the way. Like, you know, like if we had done this as Exploration Radio, like, you know, like what we would have done is we would have done all these interviews off the air. Like, you know, we would have talked to Aisha, Dale, Julian, Steve, Mark, Aaron off air. We would have found the commonalities between all of their kind of viewpoints by talking to them, like doing pre-interviews. Then we would have come up with like an arc of a story about Invincible. And then we would have produced all of those contents and put it together in like two or three episodes, like, you know, highly produced episodes. But I'm not sure. Like, I mean, there's some topics I think that works really well for. But I think the more I've kind of looked at is that I think you want that kind of development of research, like, you know, like on air. So, you know, it's kind of put it on there. Now, part of that is I think the podcasting landscape has changed. Like, you know, when we started, it was all very like highly, like, you know, produced, like, you know, like Serial was like the number one podcast, you know, it was highly produced, blah, blah, blah. Now I think it's becoming a little bit more looser and a little bit more dialogue driven. But that's been, for me, that's been the most interesting part of the Discovery Files, is that we get to kind of put our research on air and stuff like this, which I think, I don't know, maybe people like it and maybe people think it's a complete waste of time. Yeah. But
find out.
Yeah, that's all right. What about you? I mean, this is the first time you're doing a podcast. Like, what are things that surprised you? What are things that you thought were the same when you went along?
So I think,
what were your expectations? Let's start with that.
I guess, like, when I first started talking about doing this, I was kind of envisioning more of the style of like Exploration Radio, with a lot of producing and work up front. And it kept me from starting, because I've got kids, you know, I've got five kids. And so it gets very busy. And there's often interruptions, like right before we started recording, you know, some of my kids had woken up the baby, and it's like, all right, you know, let's not do that right now. And so I guess, almost through, like, again, happenstance, it was like I feel like it was like, well, this is the only format I'll be able to make this work in, you know, with my situation and everything else like that. And so it's almost like I'm even more delighted with how it's turned out than I thought I would be. Cause I thought it was like, oh, we're making a compromise by doing it this way. And then I've gone, oh, we're actually hearing people's experiences on, you know, like on air, as they're recalling it on the spot. They're not, you know, like researching things and pulling together files and, you know, like going, oh, what did that email say? And let me like review that. It's very much recollection based, which, you know, has its own flaws and things like that. But it also, what I'm really enjoying the most of it all is the people, hearing the stories of these people. And that's what I'm looking forward to the most, if we can continue going to, you know, like 100 episodes or more, you know, it's just the number of people who have fascinating stories to tell that haven't been told in this sort of a fashion before. I'm just really excited about that. So
also I think, I think, yeah, like the fact that we are pulling in so many people, I think it's gonna it's going to make it interesting, right? Because Invincible Discovery, all of those interviews are so wildly different. And yeah. I think we're going to find the same with Andover as well, in that, Paul was pretty loose. Some other people might not be as loose about, their recollections along the way, right? So I think it'd be interesting to kind of go down that path and see how it all kind of comes together.
No, I agree. It's been a delight to hear, I guess I've been just most impressed with people's willingness to just put it out there, it's not an easy thing to do, right? I think almost all of our guests have said, I hate the way my voice sounds and I don't want to hear myself speaking.
I don't want video on. Stuff like that.
But they've done it. They've gone on air and they've put themselves out there and they've added something to the investigation of what a discovery is that I don't think we would have gotten otherwise, if it had been a more
viral
environment maybe or pre-planned.
Anyway, let's see if we last all the way to 100 episodes. Other thing is I say this not to kind of like criticize Steve or anything like that, but Steve and I described our working relationship as like Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David. For anyone that's a fan of Seinfeld, one of the most anonymous stories about Seinfeld was that Jerry or Larry David would quit almost every week when he was involved in Seinfeld because he just couldn't stomach so he'd show up on a Monday wanting to write an episode and by Thursday, Friday he'd had it and he would quit, and then they would just let Larry cool down over the weekend and then you'll come back on Monday. And a large part of exploration it was the same because we had jobs, we had other pressures, and so sometimes we would be really keen on stuff like that, and other times both of us would just want to quit and give up. So it'll be interesting to see how the arc of this thing goes along with your personal pressures that your life elicits and mine, but the idea is that we should be a little bit wiser for it, I think, this time around.
I think that's, it's been really enjoyable. I actually reflected, especially in the Nick Tate interview, because I know you couldn't make it to that one. I really missed having, because you're always a very good foil to my line of questioning and reasoning and things. And so I always enjoy hearing what you're going to ask. And so when you didn't call in, because everything else going on, I was like, dang, this is not the same. This is a lot harder to do.
Yeah, I know. And I think, that's also another thing is that I think, your and my rapport, I think, is makes it a lot easier to kind of produce the content as well, right? Whereas I think, if it's just you, I think it's a lot harder. So but these are all kind of lessons you learn as you kind of go through it, right? But my interest is to kind of create, my version of the Slap TV miniseries, right? It's the same event but looked at from completely different eyes, and how different can it be? And what would be interesting is if you get a Discovery story where there's a lot of alignment in what people talk about, I think that would be really interesting to see what makes that story different compared to everyone else.
That'll be fascinating. It's been fun. I think for me, people are the most important thing on the planet, and then their stories are so individual, and so you get a view into each person we talk to, and so I've really enjoyed just the personal side of all of this.
Digging deep where the story's high, through the hills and the mountains wide, pickaxe swing and the earth unfolds, chasing dreams in the dirt and gold. Geology calling under our feet, secrets are buried in the rock and heat. With a heart full of wonder and a map in hand, exploring the treasures of this great land.